Good evening and welcome everybody to this edition of Marcel in Action, January 10th, 2018, our first show of the year. Tonight we have a full lineup of action. We're going to be talking about a plethora of litigation that's unfolding in the state of Illinois. I'm Larry Neely. I'm on the board of directors of Marcel. We have a lot of assistance putting this program together tonight from the Illinois Voices team, and Scott is here, and he's going to facilitate a great portion of the call. And we have our producer, Andy, who's here in the background. We'd be chatting with me from time to time as we have any issues arise. Everyone, welcome again. We have people still joining us, so it probably be worthwhile to remind people what we're doing maybe a half hour into the call because people are still joining in. We are recording this conference call tonight, so anybody who misses the entire event, you will be able to hear it again later on playback. So Scott from Illinois Voices has done a lot of work preparing this call, lighting up the guests, and preparing the questions for these cases. Marcel is involved in one of the cases, which Scott will explain later. So we're going to move very quickly into the program. So, Scott, thank you for joining us, and thank you for the work that you have done in setting this call up. So I'm going to hand off co-hosting to you, and I will be largely silent, except for I will be helping us transition to the breaks that we'll be doing at the top of each hour. We'll take 3 to 4 minutes for people to take a break and stretch their legs and do whatever they need to do. You'll hear promotional announcements from Marcel. And then you'll hear the music, which I could barely hear the news sounder that starts the call when we're going to resume. So, Scott, welcome and thank you. And are we ready to proceed?
Okay. All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome. This is Scott, and I'm the Director of Legal Affairs for Illinois Voices for Reform. Over the next 2 hours, we'll be examining three constitutional challenges to the sex offender laws in the state of Illinois that will be argued in the state and federal courts this year. We have three attorneys with us tonight, the attorneys who filed these lawsuits and who will be arguing them in court. You can find more details on these cases by clicking the legal link on the Illinois Voices website at ilvoices.org. So our first guest, Deborah, she's having some difficulty dialing in. Is it Andy who's helping out?
Andy, yes.
He's got her phone number. Could he give her a phone call on her cell number that he has for her and find out why she's having difficulty? She just called me on my cell, and she's not able to dial into the conference bridge. It keeps saying the phone number's not available or something, so she's not able to get on. So we can start. What we're going to do is we're going to start with Catherine. And we'll come back to Deborah at the bottom of at 7:30 if we can get her on the call. So, Deborah, Andy will call you, okay?
Perfect.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
All right, so I had her on myself. Okay, so we're going to start with Catherine. Are we able to unmute her? She put herself into the queue.
Okay, we can do that if we can find her. That would be...
Yeah, she's star sixed, so...
So... Is that the 312?
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Scott. It's Catherine.
There she is. Okay.
Hi.
Let's start, and then we'll try to get Deborah on at 7:30. Okay. First lawsuit. We'll start with lawsuit number two on our list. This is People of Illinois versus Pepitone. This case challenges the constitutionality of the Illinois park presence and loitering restrictions. Catherine Stroll, the attorney for Mr. Pepitone, is here with us tonight to talk about the case, which is on appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court. The case has been briefed to the court, and oral argument was held just yesterday. The audio and video for the argument is available on the Illinois Supreme Court website at illinoiscourts.gov, and you can just click on oral argument. Audio and video under the Supreme Court heading if you want to watch that. We're now awaiting a decision from this highest court, and that decision is expected sometime probably in the next 2 months. So Catherine graduated with a Juris Doctor, JD, in criminal litigation from the Chicago-Kent College of Law at the Illinois Institute of Technology in 2015. She started her career as a law clerk, worked for almost 2 years as an assistant appellate defender, and since July 2017 has been working independently as the sole proprietor for the Stroll Center for Justice. Her specialty is in criminal defense and appeals, with a specific interest in constitutional sex offender legislation. Catherine, welcome to the call.
Thanks, Scott. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, so we'll start off with the first question. For those that are not familiar with the case, can you briefly explain the history of the case and the claims that were asserted by the defendant appellee Mark Pepitone in the Illinois Appellate Court?
Yes, and so this is not a lawsuit. This isn't a civil matter. This is all stems from his initial criminal conviction over 14 years ago. That got him labeled a child sex offender, and that makes the statute that we're challenging in this case apply to him. So the statute, let's call it the Park statute, that statute makes it unlawful for any sexual predator or child sex offender to knowingly be present in any public park building or on real property comprising any public park. My client, Mark, was arrested when he was walking his dog in a park. He was no longer on the registry, but the statute applied. And we've since challenged the statute. At the appellate court, the third district, we raised two issues. We challenged the statute as a facial constitutional challenge through substantive due process. And then the second issue was an ex post facto as applied to Mr. Pepitone. Now, a substantive due process challenge requires a few steps. Substantive due process basically prohibits the government from depriving a person of life, liberty, or property without the due process of law. Here, liberty interests are certainly infringed upon by the statute. So we have to ask, the question becomes, are these interests of a fundamental right nature or not? If they're not, a different test applies. And the court has not found, free access to public parks to be fundamental. So that's why we're applying the rational basis test in this case. And that test asks whether the statute bears a reasonable relationship to a legitimate government interest. The third district, the appellate court, decided the case on the first issue, which obviated the need to even get to the second issue, and they said that this is the statute is facially unconstitutional.
Okay. Okay. And I think you just answered question number two.
Oh, so okay. I see that that's question two. Well, let me explain their reasoning. The reason they said it's facially unconstitutional is because it's just not reasonably related to its goal of protecting the public, or particularly children, from people who are branded child sex offenders or sexual predators, in that it's just too broad. It's too broad because it arbitrarily restricts too much innocent conduct and too many rights due to people just by virtue of being citizens and taxpayers. So that was the appellate court's reasoning.
Okay. All right. Now I have a three-part question for you, and we're going to find out a little bit more for people on the call who are wondering, what is rational basis review?
So the U.S. Supreme Court has defined the rational basis test as asking the court to examine whether a statute bears a reasonable relationship to a legitimate government interest. Our Supreme Court, the Illinois Supreme Court, has laid out a three-step analysis in sort of making the determination as to whether a statute does bear this reasonable relationship to a legitimate interest. And so step one for the Illinois Supreme Court is identifying interest and determining whether it's legitimate. Here at the court, nobody disagrees that protecting children is a legitimate interest. So that's why they passed that hurdle. The legislators passed that hurdle. The second step is is looking at whether the statute, there's a reasonable relationship to the public interest intended to be protected. I don't think that there's much of a problem there. It's arguably reasonable to try to ban sex offenders from parks because children can be present. At least that's the state's argument. I think where the statute runs into problems, and this is basically the bulk of our argument, is step three, which asks whether the message used is reasonable. And this sort of ties into the second part of your question, which is why do I think it fails rational basis review? I think it fails because the method is totally unreasonable. And
the method all right, is unreasonable. I think you can hear me, right?
Yep.
Okay, cool. So then I've got to unmute myself in the call. And now I don't hear anything from the call.
Oh, you've got Deborah on the call? Andy?
Yeah, we've got the producer working in the background, and he thought he was muted, but he isn't.
Oh, okay. Keep going. The producer's speaking.
Yeah, I can take care of that if he doesn't figure it out.
So the reason the statute step three is problematic for the third step in this rational basis review is because the method is unreasonable. The method is unreasonable because it's just too broad, and we can see that it's too broad in sort of three separate ways. The first is if when we look at statistics, we see that child victimization does not happen in parks. Child victimization, 77% of child victimization, sexual assault against children, occur in homes. Only 7% of child sexual victimization is committed by a stranger. And less than 8% of all sex offenses happen in parks. So just, you know, combining those three figures, those three statistics, the link between a recidivist sex offender committing a sex offense who is also a stranger against a child in a park is tenuous, if non-existent. Another problem with the statute, with the method, which makes it unreasonable, is that it impairs so much innocent activity that has absolutely no connection to the harm that the statute is aiming to prevent. Because parks are much more than just places with playgrounds or grassy areas. But the core, the legislator has defined parks as all bikeways, trailways, conservation areas, any public park land throughout the entire state of Illinois, and then any public building on any park land. So when we start looking at what that means, we see that child sex offenders and sex predators can never go to any of some of Chicago's most iconic museums, which are on public park property, like the Art Institute, the Shedd Aquarium, the Museum of Science and Industry, etc. They can never go to a bear's den that sit on public property. They can never participate in an adult-only evening sports league hosted through the Chicago Park District. And I'm just using Chicago as an example, but this is throughout the entire state. And, I mean, the list of activities that have no connection to preventing a sex offense against a child in a park, it's immeasurable. So that speaks to unreasonableness of the method. And when we look at other statutes, the third reason we can argue that the method is unreasonable is comparing the statute, the breadth of the statute, the sweep of the statute to other statutes that have been upheld. These other statutes also were presence restriction statutes, but there was always a limiting provision or an exception, or one would be able to gain permission to be present in a school zone, for example, if they were a parent and they had an activity of their child.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
I was just going to comment. I was going to move on to the next piece. I think you've done a good job covering that. I remember from yesterday's oral argument, and this gets into the next question. My next question is, why does the state believe the law passes that review based on yesterday's oral argument? One thing I remember the attorney for the state saying was something about ice cream trucks. I don't know if you want to relate that story, but why does the state believe the law passes the rational basis review?
The state explained why they think it passes. They said that the statute is clearly rational. It's inherently logical. It makes perfect sense to ban child sex offenders from parks because children play in parks. So, and we don't want child sex offenders near children. So the statute survives. They didn't really conduct an in-depth analysis. And, rational basis review is a very difficult standard to surmount for a person challenging a statute unconstitutional under it. The state didn't really make much of a reasoned argument other than to say it sort of makes sense. I don't know if as far as the ice cream, I mean, an issue that the justices have with the park statute that we're challenging is that there's absolutely no requirement that children are even present in the park or in any of these activities, these adult-only activities. And so they're saying, isn't there kind of not a rational connection? They can't go to a park, but a child isn't even in a park, or the statute doesn't require that a child be in a park. And the state said, well, you can never know when a child is going to enter the park. The same way sex offenders aren't allowed to operate an ice cream truck, just because a child isn't currently purchasing an ice cream cone doesn't mean they can't come walking down. They're not a half block away on their way to the truck. That was the state's rationale.
Mm-hmm. They talked about the ice cream truck law. And one of the justices said, oh, is that one of our laws?
Yeah, she was surprised that was the law.
You never heard that that's one of our laws, that if you're a child sex offender, you can't drive an ice cream truck.
I think one of the most important takeaways from yesterday and hearing the questions from the justices, and this is not something we've brought up yet, is that there's another statute on the book that is better targeted to the harm it's aiming to prevent. That statute, which is in conflict with our statute, that statute does not prohibit the presence of a child sex offender or sex predator on parkland or buildings on parkland at all. They're allowed to be present at any time and for any reason. What they are prohibited from doing when present is approaching, contacting, or communicating with the child unless their own child is present in the park. So that statute seems to bear much more of a rational relationship to the harm it seeks to prevent. And many of the justices had a number of questions for both sides about this statute. But I do think that statute is problematic for the state because it is more reasonable, it speaks to the unreasonableness of our park statute, the one that we're challenging.
Okay, let me go on to the next question. I'm not sure if we have Deborah on yet.
You do.
We do. Excellent. Okay, we'll take you next then. All right, two more questions. So what would happen if the Illinois Supreme Court affirms the appellate court ruling?
If they affirm?
Yeah.
I would expect the state will appeal it up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
They won't. The state will rest in that decision.
There's no way to predict what they're going to do, but I would think that they would try to take this to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Does it open the door to more restrictive and unreasonable laws?
You and I discussed this, the slippery slope that the court is dealing with, regardless of how they decide the case, because if they find in favor of my clients and they uphold the ruling below, if they uphold the ruling with some of the same rationale that the court below used, which was so much innocent conduct is swept into the statute. It's too broad and unreasonable. That's going to be tricky for every other type of collateral consequence sex offender statute, because the same can be said for basically almost all of them. So they're probably, if they do want to affirm the appellate court's holding, they're probably going to try to find a different rationale to do so. If they reverse and say, no, this statute is constitutional, they're basically giving the legislator, they're implying to the legislator that the legislator can do whatever they want with child sex offender legislation. They can ban them absolutely anywhere. If the rationale is they're inherently dangerous and they can't be near where children are, children are present in all public places.
Justice Mary Jane Theis, at yesterday's oral argument, one of the first questions she asked you was, how far can the legislature go before, or she asked the state, how far can the legislature go before a law becomes irrational? Mm-hmm. And I think she brought up that example of, that they could possibly ban child sex offenders from being in any public buildings.
Well, she said, I think he said it would be irrational to have a child sex to ban them from wearing the color red because children might potentially be attracted. Mm-hmm. I don't know about the right time for when he used that example, but
that was his example, right?
And it was a weak response, in my opinion.
Yeah, I have to note here that, I did look at some background on an attorney, and he's a creative writer, and he certainly was creative in his answers yesterday. One other thing, I think I noted also there was a comment about, domestic abuse. Also the same justice made a comment about how these laws could even restrict people convicted of other offenses. I think she asked the state, why wouldn't we also want to prevent people convicted of domestic abuse from being in the parks?
Mm-hmm. Right. She said, you're targeting a subclass of people. Yes, they have a felony conviction, but, what about other people with felony convictions? Would it be rational to ban, anybody who's been convicted for domestic abuse? The state said, yes, that would be rational. And he said, because that would be rational, it shows just how rational the park statute is. I find that logic hard to follow.
Larry, would you like to ask any additional questions, or would we like to maybe open the line to maybe a couple questions before we run out of time here and go to the next interview?
I think you've done a good job covering that. We've got a queue full, but they jumped in here before we actually opened the queue, so I'm going to clear the queue, and then I'm going to ask people to get back in if you have a question for this attorney about this case. And when I say a question, I don't mean to be rude, but it better sound like you're asking a question within about the first seven or eight words, because otherwise you're giving a speech, and we're not going to listen to speeches. We'd like a question for our guests. So I'm going to clear the queue and ask anyone who would like to ask a question to this attorney about this case to please hit *6, press *6 on your phone, and we will get to you in the order that you are entering the queue. So right now there's nobody in the queue because I cleared it. So *6 will put you in the queue. And, of course, if you're listening on live stream, you won't be able to get into the queue without calling in. So, Scott, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. You got really quiet. I thought maybe I cleared everybody.
Are there any questions, Patty? We'll have another opportunity for questions in an hour. So you don't know, but we just have a little extra time here right now if you want to ask a question specifically about this lawsuit.
Well, I was not able to find enough time to listen to the oral argument, so I don't really have an intelligent question to ask. We do have one in the so we're gonna put this person on the air.
I think Catherine is muted, so we might have to unmute her.
I'm in Illinois. I live in Lincoln. I was asking if this law or this thing is on hold at present. Is there some kind of a stay of making it legal, or are they, I mean, so that you can't be arrested? Like, we have a beautiful gym here, you know what I mean? I'd love to go for it, but right now I can't. It's a gym in a park, a local park.
Larry, were you able to unmute Catherine?
I don't see her muted.
I just wondered if there was a stay of execution or a stay of enforcement.
I think I can answer that based on what I've heard from Catherine. My understanding is that no, there's not. It's possible that if you're in a park that the state might delay prosecution, you could still be arrested for being in a park. I also heard that what she said in court yesterday was that the first district, which is like Cook County in Chicago, because of this lawsuit and because the third district appellate court struck down the law as being unconstitutional, they've actually been charging people under the other statute, which is the A-10 statute, the 9.3A-10, which is the one that says you have to be approaching kids in a park. And obviously that has a higher standard of proof. You actually have to prove in court that you were not only in a park, but you were approaching and contacting minors in the park. And she said that she had heard from the first district that that's what they were using for charging people because of the ruling in the appellate court. Catherine's not able to speak, though. She's been muted. So, she said you should not feel comfortable going into a park. You could be arrested.
Okay,
until the law is finally struck.
Okay, did we get Catherine back?
Oh, I think I'm back.
Sorry about that. I don't know what happened.
That was basically all of that was correct. The statute's only been found to be unconstitutional in the third district, in the counties covered by the third district. An appellate court ruling does not speak to the entire state. So, but even if you're in the third district, in a county which is in the third district, covered by the third district, and I don't know what county you're in, people are still being arrested under the statute. Now, they should not be prosecuted, because the statute's currently unconstitutional, but I don't know what the state's attorneys are doing with those cases. So, no, don't go to a park. It's just too risky.
We'd like to cover one more point, actually, that we missed. Catherine, why don't you cover that last point that we haven't covered?
Because there were two issues raised in the third district, but only one was decided, because by deciding the larger issue, which was great for us, there was no need to decide the second issue. But because of that, if the Illinois Supreme Court decides to disagree with the appellate court and say, no, this statute is constitutional, we're reversing your judgment, then the procedural process is, this case, then if we lose, we have to go back down to the appellate court to have the appellate court decide that second issue, that narrower issue, the ex post facto issue, and then from there appeal it back up to the Illinois Supreme Court, and then from there, you know, try to take it to the next level.
Now, of course, if this law is struck down the ex post facto, the implication eventually would be that anyone convicted, 2011 or later,
uh-huh.
Or whose offense was 2011 or later, or is it date of conviction?
I believe it's the date of commission, but I don't know if it's the final. And Deborah or Adele might know the answer to that.
So if someone's convicted 2011 or later,
yeah,
then the park restrictions would apply. Otherwise, they wouldn't.
Right.
So that's the ultimate. So this case could go back to the appellate court, could go back to the Illinois Supreme Court again later in the year. Eventually, this could end up, the whole thing could end up in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right. This is a great case for the U.S. Supreme Court, whichever issue we're considering.
All right. I think we need to move on, but thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, appreciate it. So let's move on. Can we move on now to our? We'll move on to our first case.
That sounds good, Scott. We'll just remind everybody that's been joining us. We will have this recorded show available for playback shortly after the conclusion of the program. So we're going to be taking a break at the top of each hour of about 4 minutes for people to rest and do what they need to do, and you'll hear music and advertising for various Norrisville affiliates, and then we'll be back in action at the top of the hour. So thanks, God, and you can take over again. And at about 4 minutes before the hour, we'll take a break, and you'll hear music start in the background.
Okay. All right. We just did lawsuit number two, so we're going to go to lawsuit number one. This is the case of People of Illinois versus Bingham. This case is challenging the constitutionality of a 2011 amendment to the Illinois Sex Offender Registration Act that requires lifetime registration for a defendant who is convicted of any felony who previously had been convicted of a registrable sex offense. The attorney, Deborah Null, who represents Mr. Bingham, is here with us tonight to talk about the case, which is on appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court. They lost the case in the previous court. The case is currently being briefed to the court, and oral argument is expected sometime early this year. Deborah graduated with a Juris Doctor from the Chicago Kent College of Law at the Illinois Institute of Technology in 2006. She's currently an assistant appellate defender for the Illinois Office of the State Appellate Defender in the First District, which covers like Cook County, City of Chicago, where she's been working for the past 9 years. Deborah, welcome to the call.
Thanks, Scott.
All right.
Sorry about the snafu.
No problem. So we have a few questions for Deborah about the case. So first of all, for those who are not familiar with the case, can you briefly explain the history of the case and the claims that are being asserted by the defendant appellant, Jerome Bingham?
So Mr. Bingham was convicted in 1983 of attempted criminal sexual assault, and he never had to register as a sex offender because there were no applicable laws at that time. Until 2014, he was convicted of stealing, I think, like a few pallets from a Kmart parking lot. So it's a minor theft, a misdemeanor theft that was elevated to a felony because of a prior retail theft conviction from 10 years before that. And I got the case on appeal from that theft conviction. And we raised two issues. One, we raised an as-applied due process argument, arguing that in this case, what's different from Catherine's case, we didn't raise a facial challenge. We just said that in this case, there's no rational relationship between the minor theft and SORA's purpose of protecting the public from sex offenders. And then we also raised an ex post facto challenge to the 2012 amendment, arguing that that amendment retroactively punishes people who were not previously subject to SORA's registration requirements. So it's a very narrow, my arguments are narrow.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The state hasn't filed its brief yet to the Illinois Supreme Court. What were the state's arguments in the brief that they filed in the appellate court?
They argued, regarding the due process challenge, they argued that the record was not sufficient for us to raise an as-applied challenge, which is kind of a technical argument. And then they said that even if the record were sufficient, the argument should fail because anyone who commits a felony poses a danger to the public, and therefore there's a rational relationship between the retroactivity provision and the state's purpose in monitoring sex offenders. So they just sort of ignored all of the detailed arguments that I made and said, you know, if they commit a crime, they're dangerous, and therefore they need to be monitored. And regarding the ex post facto argument, the state basically relied on prior decisions, both from the Illinois Appellate Court and the Illinois Supreme Court, holding that the Sex Offender Registration Act is a civil regulation, not punishment, and therefore it's not subject to ex post facto protections, which only apply to criminal penalties.
Okay. So I think we started getting into question three a little bit. It's, what is the Illinois Supreme Court's history in ruling on registration as punishment? I guess we can talk about the Melchow case, and then what has changed, what in your opinion has changed in the Illinois law since that time that could possibly change the court's opinion.
So I'm going to just cover real quick three cases, because Maltow actually relied on an earlier case, People versus Adams, which is a 1991 decision. And that was the first challenge to a much earlier version of SORA. And the Illinois Supreme Court held that that version of the statute was not punishment because at that time, the statute didn't really impose severe disabilities. It didn't have, you know, the internet didn't really exist then. And so what the court said is the statute does not impose a severe disability on registrants where the relatively simple act of complying is an innocuous duty compared to the potential alternative of spending an extended period of years in prison. So that's 1991. And then in 2000, the court considered Maltow. And in that case, Adams was actually a Eighth Amendment challenge. So in Maltow, the defendant raised an ex post facto challenge to both the 1998 version of SORA and also the community notification law, which was new at that time. And so what the Supreme Court did is they just relied on Adams to say that SORA was not punishment, even though Adams had considered an earlier version of the law. And then the court further held that the defendant failed to meet his burden to show that the community notification law was punishment. So the analysis was fairly superficial. And then in 2004, the court revisited the question in People versus Cornelius, which followed the United States Supreme Court's decision in Smith versus Doe. So Cornelius simply relied on Smith v. Doe and said that the that it wasn't punishment. So that's the history of the Illinois Supreme Court's decisions. And what's changed since then is basically the registry requirements. I mean, they've just become, as everyone on this call knows, increasingly more onerous. I mean, you know, I think in my brief I talk about, like, it's a rite of passage in Springfield for legislators to come up with a new way to punish sex offenders. And then there's also been, in my opinion, an increased public recognition by both scholars and courts that these registries have evolved into something that is punishment. So I don't know what's going to happen in my case, but there's definitely a lot of people recognizing this is a problem. I mean, you hear stories on NPR, there's, you know, articles in Salon, it's everywhere, The New Yorker. There's just, the world seems to have changed dramatically. And it sounds like from Catherine's argument that the Illinois Supreme Court is not immune to that.
Mm-hmm. Did you watch the argument? Or
I have not. I started to listen to it, and then I've had the flu, and I just I couldn't do it.
There's been a couple other cases, pretty well-known cases nationwide now that a lot of people on this call are probably familiar with. We'll discuss those briefly. So the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit Court ruled in Doe v. Snyder, that was August of 2016, that the Michigan SORA imposes retroactive punishment. And then the U.S. Supreme Court refused a request for certiorari by the state of Michigan just October of last year. How does the Doe v. Snyder case compare to this case, and will it likely affect the Illinois Supreme Court's ruling?
So Doe v. Snyder is similar to our case to Bingham in that Michigan SORA is really similar to Illinois SORA, and the Illinois Appellate Court has recognized that, at least one, I know of one case that the court recognized that. But it differs from, Bingham differs from Snyder primarily because of the procedural posture. So my case, Bingham, is a criminal appeal from a theft conviction. So this, the issues that I'm raising now were not addressed at all below. Like, my client didn't know he was going to have to register as a sex offender until he was sentenced. Like, that just wasn't an issue at all. Whereas Snyder was a civil proceeding that the plaintiffs sued the state to enjoin enforcement of SORA. So that meant that there was evidence gathered about the ways in which the statute affected their lives. But they're just completely different. I mean, in some ways, I'm a little bit worried about Snyder because of that fact, because there are so much, the record is so much better developed about the effect of SORA on those people as compared to my client. In terms of the effect that it will have, I have no idea, honestly. I think it falls into that, the big bucket of all the different people that aren't starting to wake up and notice that, yes, the sex offender registries are crazy, and they are punishment, and that it's a legal fiction to pretend like they're not. So in that aspect, yes, it can help. I don't know, like I said, I'm a little bit concerned just because the contrast with that record being so fleshed out with my case, where there's nothing at all about the effect of sex offender registration on my client. I think that, yeah, we'll just see. I mean, you know, it's a great case. It's mm-hmm. just, I don't know how much it'll help me.
Okay, let's talk about the last one. So the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in July of 2017 ruled in the Muniz case that their SORNA registration provisions constituted punishment, and that retroactive application of SORNA's registration provisions violated the federal and Pennsylvania state ex post facto clauses. How does that case compare?
In this case, I think is much more helpful for me, for my client. So Mr. Muniz was convicted of two sex offenses that would have required registration for 10 years. And he, between the time of his conviction and his sentencing, he absconded. And by the time they found him, he returned and was in court for sentencing, the law had changed from a 10-year registration requirement to a lifetime registration requirement. So Mr. Muniz filed a post-sentence motion requesting registration under the more favorable law. The trial court denied relief. The appellate court, you know, agreed with the trial court, and the Supreme Court reversed. And the Supreme Court's decision is important for several reasons. I'm just going to highlight three, or really four. So as you said, it holds that the Pennsylvania SORA violates both the federal and the state ex post facto clauses. In terms of the federal, one of the things that's really helpful is that court uses the federal clearest ground standard, which is a really, really tough standard to meet. So there are cases around the country where Supreme Courts have found that their state SORA violates ex post facto laws, but a lot of times they use a lower standard. This court uses that tough standard and says, you know what, even under this tough standard, these provisions and it's punishment. And then the biggest thing that I love about this case is that the court emphasizes the impact of technology in holding, and then quote unquote, but SORNA's publication provisions, when viewed in the context of our current internet-based world, are comparable to shaming punishments. And that's huge. They're saying straight out what everyone knows, but so many courts are pretending isn't true. And I think, you know, Packingham, the United States Supreme Court case for First Amendment is also great on that point. But the third reason why I love this case is the court said, yes, this violates the federal prohibitions on against ex post facto. But also, you know what, even if the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court decides that it doesn't agree with us, we're going to find that it also violates the Pennsylvania Constitution. So it's insulating itself from review. And also that's helpful because, you know, it's really brave. And I can point to that. And I have pointed to that in my briefs to show the Illinois Supreme Court, like, hey, Illinois Supreme Court, look what this other Supreme Court did. Maybe you can be brave too, because there's strength in numbers. Because, you know, these courts, at least here, they're politicians and they want to be popular mm-hmm. and they're scared. So yeah, I think Muniz has the potential to be really helpful. I mean, of course, it's only persuasive authority because it's another state, but I have more hope for that case than I do for Snyder.
So what happens if the Illinois Supreme Court agrees that this is ex post facto punishment? Does that just affect Mr. Bingham and he just doesn't have to register anymore?
If they agree that it's ex post facto punishment, it will affect Mr. Bingham, and it also will affect everyone else who was subject to the 2011 amendment. So anyone who was never required to register before, or I mean, it would like that's the broader argument. Mm-hmm. So it would help a lot of people, actually. It wouldn't help everyone, but it would help a lot of people.
The Illinois State Police would have to go review the entire registry to figure out who comes off. Right.
I don't know what would happen in terms of the practical.
Right.
But
okay.
But the you know, the other possibility, if we win, is we could win on the very narrow due process grounds, which that would only affect Mr. Bingham. It would be a tiny little chink in the wall that other people could use that case to say, you know, look at my case that I don't deserve this either, but it would be
but
a very
just say, as applied to Mr. Bingham, we agree, but not as a whole. This isn't punishment for everyone.
That is my due process argument, is only Mr. Bingham. Okay. And the reason why we raised it that way is because our facts are so sympathetic, and because it's a much, like Catherine was saying, the rational basis standard is really, really, really tough. So the as-applied standard is much looser. You don't have to show that there's no circumstances in which the statute can ever be constitutional. I just have to show that it's unconstitutional as applied to him. So it's a much lower burden. And because, you know, I'm not a policy attorney, I represent each client at a time, so I have to do what's best for that client.
Right.
So from a policy standpoint, it bums me out because it would suck to, like, win for Mr. Bingham and not be able to help anyone else. But from a, you know, for my client, it would be awesome.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But
yeah,
I am hopeful
would be the basis.
That they find it.
Yeah, it would be a basis for others to challenge their own registration, right? You know, well, Mr. Bingham doesn't have to register. Well, here's my case. You want to hear my case?
Right.
And you'll start seeing all these cases popping up.
I mean, that's sort of the approach that Indiana Supreme Court has done. It's not exactly, theirs aren't due process, but they've done like ex post facto claims on a case-by-case basis, basically. I'm oversimplifying, but it's basically what it is. It's like, you know, it's a really small window, but it's better than no window. But I'm hopeful that they will go a little further in this case and hold that it is punishment. I think that's I think it's a legally correct thing to do.
How soon do you think the oral argument will be? When will it occur? April?
It depends on when the state filed its brief. The state's current due date is January 26th. I don't know if they'll file it on time. If they do, the oral argument will probably be in March. Then if they don't file it, then I can't remember the Supreme Court's schedule. I think it would be, I don't remember when the next date would be there to have argument.
Well, Larry, do we want to take a question or two? Well, I would
love to take some questions, Scott. So the rational basis review for everyone, I'll just add my two cents. Where it's really confusing to people because the rational basis doesn't mean it has to get a rational result. It means when the lawmakers are saying we want to do something about a problem, it's whether the desire to do something about a problem is rational. It's not whether I do the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. If you've been on my calls before, you've heard that a number of times. But a rational basis, simply that they want to improve road safety, is the rational basis. Whether or not the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit is effective and a good public policy is not for judicial determination, because those are policy choices that are being made, and the courts don't substitute their judgment. So a rational basis review is so difficult because if they can come up with any rational basis for the lawmakers to have enacted a law to address that perceived problem, then that ends the review. Do I have that right, Counselor?
I mean, yes, I think that has been I think that's what's happened. But also, again, the Packingham decision, the United States Supreme Court case, that case has some great language saying, like, you know, rational basis review doesn't mean you can just do anything you want.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, I think like so many other things, like there's courts that do whatever they want, and that rational basis does allow them to do whatever they want.
So let's go to the questions. Press star 6 if you're interested in asking this attorney a question about this case. And as I said on the last segment, please get to a question. So the first couple sentences should sound like you're moving towards a question. If it sounds like you're moving towards a speech, I will place you back in the queue for a later review. So here we go. You're on NARSL in action. Go ahead with your question. Are you there?
Yeah, hi. Sorry. I actually tried to join the first question. So I don't really have a question for this attorney.
Okay, well, then we'll get back to you when we go to the next series of questions. We're going to do questions a couple more times tonight, so thanks. So we're going to the next person. You're on Arsenal in Action. What is your question?
Yes, I was arrested in 2006, charged with possession of child pornography. My case was finally adjudicated in 2009, and at that point it was through a plea, and I was found guilty and sentenced to probation, and then was required at that point to be on the registry for a period of 10 years. Sometime after that, I think within a matter of a couple months, actually, I was notified by my probation officer that there had been a legislative change, and I now was classified not only as a sex offender, but as a, I'm trying to think of the term.
sexual predator?
A predator, right. And now I was subject to the registry for a lifetime. It was a major blow to me, that obviously, to say the least. I'll be 80 years old in a couple months, so maybe I shouldn't worry too much about it. But I've talked to a number of people who said this was an ex post facto change and it should not go through that way. But anyway, that's where I'm at. So.
So I'm not sure what your question is.
Well, the question is, I was originally charged with a crime, and it was through a plea, and I was subject to, at that point, requirements to be on this registry for a period of 10 years. And then at a subsequent date, within a matter of a few months or so, I was notified that I was now subject to a lifetime requirement.
So are you wondering if the Bingham decision would affect you?
Yes. Uh-huh.
I guess I don't know the answer to that because I don't know exactly the details of your, the dates of your offense. Like, Bingham is challenging very narrowly the 2012 amendment that renders the Sex Offender Registration Act retroactive to people who weren't previously required to register. So I guess what I would suggest is contacting an attorney who's in private practice. So maybe either Adele or Catherine to ask for advice. I'm not permitted to, I only represent people.
Yeah, I'm not asking.
No, I know. And I'm just being 100% clear. Like, I don't, like, I would love to answer. I just don't,
I've had a number of attorneys say, yes, it was an ex post facto and it's probably unconstitutional, but you have to go through some kind of a process to get that result. Now, this has nothing to do with that question, but listening to the program tonight, I had been arrested in July of this year because I was in a state park. And I was in the state park because of the flooding situations. And I was charged and subsequently had to go through a number of hearings. And finally, we entered a plea of guilty. And I'm on a one-year I forget the term. It's I don't have to do anything.
You're on unsupervised release.
Yeah, supervised. Yeah, it's like getting a driver's, thing. And so I will successfully complete that, I'm sure. But it seemed to me that I was in no contact with children. I was just driving. In fact, I never got out of my car. I was just driving through the roadway that goes through the park in order to turn around and avoid a flooding situation on the highway that it was on. But and I'm not asking a question about that. I'm really after the other issue more than anything else. So I guess what I should do is proceed, maybe have some further contact with some other attorney. And Scott, I don't know, you know who I am.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get you in touch with another attorney.
Yeah,
on that.
That would be good, because I would like to at least get some clarification on that. That'd be fine. Thank you very much for all your work, by the way.
Sure.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Mm-hmm. I don't believe we have enough time to squeeze in another question because we're going to start hearing the music that's going to lead us to a brief timeout. So, did you have any final words, Scott, or either one of you before we wind up this segment?
I don't. Deborah, do you have anything else to add?
Nope.
Well, It's been great having you here, and you're welcome to stay for as long as you like for the next segment. And you can also stay for the open phone portion we're going to do for the final hour. We appreciate you coming in and giving your time to talk about this case tonight.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Scott, what I'm going to do here is let everybody know that we're going to take a brief time out here at the top of the hour. We'll be back. And we look forward to you joining for much of the program as you can. This is NARSL in Action, special Illinois program for January 10th.